Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cheese and Pickle. Hello, this is Comfort Blanket and I'm Joel Morris. I'm going to be talking to someone who makes cool stuff that I like about some warm stuff that they like. A book or a TV show or a film or a record they go back to again and again for comfort. This time I'm talking to the writer and actor, Larry Rickard. Larry is currently best known for his work on Ghosts, the hit BBC One sitcom where he plays the caveman Robin as well as the headless spectre Humphrey. He also co-wrote and created the show with five of his friends. So it's really neat that what Larry has chosen for his comfort blanket is another hit mainstream comedy starring six friends. The show Friends. This is part one of two, so there'll be two of these, another one along in a minute. Hope you enjoy it. Podcast.
Thank you.
I've come down to see you, which is very nice.
Yes, yeah, thank you very much. Coming all this way. It's beautiful Brighton.
Exactly. It's like a road trip.
Yeah.
And it was worth it because you've chosen something really lovely to talk about. And a thing maybe that people don't talk about or aren't honest about how much they find comfort in it.
Yeah, it's become weirdly one of those guilty secrets. I suppose it's a little bit like anything that's really popular. It's a little bit like saying, well, I quite like Coldplay. But it was so big that you couldn't possibly be cool and say that you were into it. But in terms of the number of global laughs it's generated, it's got to be up there.
And it's a book! Oh, it's Dr. Seuss!
That book got me through some tough times.
There is a little child inside this man.
Yes, the doctors say if they remove it, he'll die.
There's an argument sometimes where people talk about things that they love, that's about identity. And there's a real temptation to say that I really love this thing because I can really nail my identity to it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of hard to nail our identity to ABBA.
Yeah, it's a good
and
point.
And yet, I think people should do that. I think you should say, and you've said to me, you're a really big fan of Friends. Yeah, be a really big fan of Friends. That's your identity.
Yeah.
Fine. Great.
It's true. It's normally, I suppose, everything's sort of, you know, cult and subculture. And so I'm into that band. Only 10 other people I've ever met have liked, or 400 people on my Facebook group. But yeah, to like something that too many people likes is kind of like not liking anything. I mean, it's lowest common denominator liking.
Yeah, it's a default thing. I thought what was hilarious about Oasis, they went, we're really into the Beatles. And you went, yeah, kind of assumed you probably, as being a band, you probably would be. But to find that in there and to happily admit it, to not want to try too hard, just go, I just like this because it's good.
Yeah.
And very often people are really afraid to say that really popular things are really good.
Well, I've noticed this particularly. I've had conversations in the last couple of months with young people and they and in both cases, completely by accident, the subject of the Beatles has come up and they were both really, really quick to tell me that they don't like the Beatles.
Maybe
and
that's what you do. That's how you identify yourself by
subculture.
It. Yeah,
exactly. And then I know I don't like the Beatles, and several of my friends also don't like the Beatles. And I was like, okay, that's fair enough. I said outwardly, well, inwardly screaming.
You fools.
But that's how you find subculture in something that's too big. But I think particularly because what we are talking about, whether you know this about your own podcast or not, is, you know, the idea of something being comforting. And I think part of that is in shared experience. And I think always thought there was something nice in Friends about the fact that you could just almost pick a person at random and go, did you see that thing? And they'll get that joke and that reference, and everyone knows who those characters are. And that's sort of part of the comfort of it, maybe.
How you doing?
I know!
Hey, Thieves, you want to help?
Oh, I wish I could, but I don't want to.
We were on a plane!
Yeah, you're always looking for those. It's very odd when you work in comedy and you're looking for comparisons and metaphors and character notes, especially if you do them out loud in that way that, say, Marvel does sometimes. They go, all right, Lebowski, when Thor comes in, you go, right, we all agree we've seen a film called The Big Lebowski. You're looking for those common references. Who do you think you are? And about 30, 40 years ago, you could say, who do you think you are? Russell Grant?
Yeah.
Everyone was watching television at the same time. You knew who Russell Grant was. There's an agreed culture of people. And we lack those big things that everyone can agree on. And they're great places to spring comedy from and spring companionship from and fellowship from, that you have a shared set of references. It's what Harry Potter was for a while, isn't it? Everyone, you've said, all right, you're a bit Hufflepuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Star Wars, those big brands. And Friends is one of those brands that even if you don't know the show, you probably know the names of the characters.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. And I think also you kind of know, weirdly, the rough dynamics. So everyone knows, Joey, he's the one who's not so smart, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I've had my share of bad reviews. I still remember my first good one, though. Everything else in this production of Our Town was simply terrible. Joey Tribbiani was abysmal.
And, you know, could Chandler be any more sarcastic? By osmosis, it kind of bleeds out into society, even people who've never seen it or caught the odd episode.
I can't believe you two had sex in her dream.
I'm sorry, it was a one-time thing. I was very drunk and it was someone else's subconscious.
It was so big. Do you think that's made it feel taken for granted?
But let's take one last look at the nominees for Outstanding Comedy Series. Friends! And the winner is... Friends!
When it first arrived, it was a sitcom. It was another sitcom. But within a couple of series, it's this global phenomenon. It's given the world the name for a haircut. It's become a much bigger thing and changed the way people spoke, the rhythms of speech and things. Do you think people have forgotten it was a comedy show?
Yeah, I mean, but as soon as anything becomes that big, it's really hard to imagine a world before it was there.
Yeah.
I think it was David Crane. It was certainly one of the creators who was quite open about saying that it wasn't even the show that he thought was most likely to go to series that year that he had made.
Wow.
You know, it's like, it wasn't like everyone went, this is a shoo-in. And, you know, personally, you know, my preference has always been to do things that are quite sort of high concept. And you go, there's a really graspable thing about them, and that's the USP. And the very fact that it's called Friends and it's about some friends, it's sort of really hard to hang a peg on what it is. And so it shouldn't work on paper.
Okay, everybody, this is Rachel, another Lincoln High survivor. This is everybody. This is Chandler and Phoebe and Joey. And you remember my brother Ross?
Sure.
Hey. It feels like it's of its time, maybe, is what its unique flavour is. Its USP is that it came out when it came out. It's a Gen X hangout sitcom of some sort. What this is about is some people from the early 90s.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people say this is a hot show for Generation X.
Generation X, I guess, implies that we're all aimless and we're just kind of hanging out listening to, you know, music and watching the Brady Bunch or something. I don't know, which we do.
So it's sort of, when you're pitching it, it has no flavor at all because it's about now.
Yeah.
And maybe it's increased in flavor and high concept as we've got further away from it. So now you go, oh, it's about how we were.
Yes, well, exactly. It's about the 90s now. Whereas I suppose then if it was about anything, it was about people at that time of life before they end up in couples and having children and moving away. And it's not a friendship group anymore. It's sort of before people have their individual families, they have that adopted family, which is the mates they hang out with.
Each of them has separate careers and love interests. And
are in that phase of their lives where they're not relying on their parents anymore for financial stability and are not yet settled with a husband or wife or I was, but or kids. And so we're in that kind of gray area where we're relying on our friends.
It was pitched that way. That was the thing. I said, it's right. About that time in your 20s when your friends are your family.
Yeah.
And there was a great story. They originally wanted to have another generation in it because American sitcoms very rarely are single generation. Maybe that's what was revolutionary about it. Maybe we don't know what's revolutionary about it because we weren't in the American sitcom system. It just looked like a slick, good-looking show to me.
Yeah.
But you realise that most American sitcoms had a generational thing. They had mums and dads in them and kids and things. It's your standard network show.
Yeah.
Possibly with the exception of Seinfeld, which is just some people hanging out. Mm. It's very generational. And they originally pitched the idea that it would have an older guy in it called Pat the Cop.
Right.
And they tried a version, and David Crane and Marta Kaufman went, no, it won't have an old guy called Pat the Cop.
Right.
But they put it anyway. It's like Sesame Street.
Yeah.
There's an old guy who goes, what are you up to? And it would maybe take the sting out of the fact that they were being, I don't know, promiscuous. He could frown at them. It would be a bit more Happy Daisy. There'd be sort of a Cunningham dad in there looking after them. And that might tell you what it was in terms of what it wasn't. As in, they were used to having someone who'd give them the benefit of adult experience. And yet what's unique about Friends, and maybe why it appealed to us when it came out, was it was about people that age on their own.
Yeah.
Well, it's a problem for me, which means it's a problem for you, because I'm a cop.
So am I.
And people making mistakes and not being pulled up on them, you know, which is the thing, probably feels quite sort of liberating. First, when I was first watching it, they seemed like they were slightly older and slightly more sophisticated, but I think that was probably just because they were American.
So, like, you guys all have jobs?
Yeah, we all have jobs. See, that's how we buy stuff.
But, you know, I would have been in my, late teens, very early 20s, and they would have been a couple of years older than me, but just seemed really, really
cool. Because it's very aspirational.
Yeah.
In a way that things like Dawson's Creek and things were. What did you first think when you first watched it, when it came out? Because it came out to very little fanfare.
I think from really, really early on, it made me laugh. And it made me laugh out loud. And a lot of times, even with shows that I really enjoy, I get to the end of it and I've sort of gone, oh, that was good. And I've gone, did I laugh at any point in that? There might be moments that amuse me, but only sort of inwardly. But to get to the point where an actual audible sound comes out happens relatively rarely. I remember it making me laugh. I remember it feeling sort of, it was never edgy, but I remember when they started to do the repeats at one point, they were on early morning in Channel 4, like as you were getting ready for work, they started to repeat them all. And you could see the number of nips that had been taken out of it. And you go, actually, there is stuff in there which felt like it was a little bit edgier than you're expecting from what is such a mainstream.
Because it's an 8 o'clock, it's a pre-Watershed show, and it's about sex.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, honey. Oh, that's okay.
What? Oh, no, you just rolled over the juice box.
It's about people's slightly sort of feckless sexual adventures.
Yeah.
Even they'll call it dating. But there's definitely no doubt about the fact that from the first couple of lines, you're going to watch these people hook up.
Yeah.
And they will allude to what happened last night.
Are we still talking about sex?
And it's on at 8 o'clock.
Hmm. I mean, now the show would be called My Feckless Sexual Adventures. And would be, you know, a big hit on a streamer.
Yeah. Well, this is a mainstream show. And it's the guys who've done it, Crane and Kaufman, their previous show's Dream On, which was HBO. They've come from a cult hit whose big thing was it was incredibly frank about sex.
Mm.
I think we ought to do it.
And I think maybe it's very weird now that it is now the show that everyone's sort of pre-teens are addicted to on streamers.
Yeah.
Because it's incredibly frank about sex.
No, Homo habilis was erect. Australopithecus was never fully erect.
Well, maybe he was nervous.
Yeah, I suppose it's sort of, you know, it's pre-sex education. That was about that's about as hardcore as it went in comedy.
Well, I'll throw a throw.
Consider it done.
You understood that?
Yeah, my Uncle Sal has a really big tongue.
Is he the one with the beautiful wife?
Often what people say about Friends is it is a masterclass in how to do this. Because it opens with one of the probably one of the most analysed opening scenes I've ever seen online by other writers, setting up as many characters as possible in the minimum number of lines. And the first thing that strikes you if you're a comedy writer is that this is so well crafted. It is incredibly clear.
There's nothing to tell. It's just some guy I work with.
Come on. You're going out with the guy. There's got to be something wrong with him.
So does he have a hump? A hump and a hairpiece?
Wait, does he eat chalk? Just because I don't want her to go through what I went through with Carl.
Okay, everybody relax. This is not even a date. It's just two people going out to dinner and not having sex.
Sounds like a date to me.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the characters, you know, get refined and shaped and the hard edges taken off and things that might be slightly minor traits become more major. But there's no sense of going, right, this will be the episode in which we meet Phoebe. You know, it all happens very, very quickly. But I suppose, you know, we always found that there was that division that naturally happened when we were writing Ghosts, where you kind of go, there's a part of your brain that's going, this is how many minutes we've got and this is how many people we've got to serve. And so every line has to be doing several jobs in there. It's got to be, you know, characterful, doing its little bit for plot and pushing the story forward, but also a gag. And I think that's what the opening of Friends does. By the time you get to that first ad break, you know who all the characters are, what they're like, and what their sort of their dynamic among each other is.
Yeah, it's a brilliant thing. It sets up because they're just hanging out and sitting down and having a coffee. And within four or five lines, you want to know who these guys are and what they're going to do next. And it's a brilliant set of breadcrumbs to tell you the history of everyone's relationships and how, what they think about each other.
Yeah.
And then into the middle of that, they drop at a crucial moment when you realise they've set up Ross with a complicated thing that he's a divorcee.
I don't want to be single, okay? I just want to be married again.
And I just want $1 million.
They drop a bride on him.
Yeah.
At which point you go, oh God, it's a movie. That is the most high concept thing that happens.
Yeah.
But before then, they've just been hanging out.
I just had to get out of there and I started wondering, why am I doing this and who am I doing this for? So anyway, I just didn't know where to go. And I know that you and I have kind of drifted apart, but you're the only person I knew who lived here in the city.
Who wasn't invited to the wedding.
Oh, I was kind of hoping that wouldn't be an issue.
And you do think there's a version of this which opens with the jilted bride and goes, oh, it's about her and her journey into the city and finding a new friendship group. But instead of it, they flip round and you're with a settled bunch of people first.
Mm.
So instead of following someone in who's the hero, and my God, Jennifer Aniston has probably made 10 films where that's the setup, that she's a jilted bride.
Yeah.
And she runs away and finds a new family, wherever they are, on the Orkneys, at the bottom of the sea. She's made those films.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish me luck.
What for?
I'm going to go get one of those job things.
But you start with the settled group. And it's a way of saying it's not about someone who started a new life.
No.
This is about a group of people.
Hmm. You said we should do it again. That's good, right?
No. Loosely translated, we should do this again means you will never see me naked. Mm.
Since when?
Since always. It's like dating language, you know, like, it's not you means it is you.
Or you're such a nice guy means I'm going to be dating leather-wearing alcoholics and complaining about them to you.
Or you know, I think we should see other people means, I already am.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you're starting with it as an ensemble thing. Then you go, the traditional wisdom is always, you know, with anything where you're worrying about story and plot, is how quickly can you get through the first act to get to an inciting incident and start these things off? And, you know, there must be a way we can lose a line and lose that page and that chapter and that beat and get it quicker, quicker, quicker. Whereas I suppose if this is about an ensemble of people and how they interact with each other, you go, well, that's what we set up and what we enjoy. What we have is actually a really long first act.
Yeah.
And then one inciting incident comes in far too late. You know, far later than you would naturally put it.
So you want to tell us now, or are we waiting for four wet bridesmaids?
Weirdly, you may know this as a technician. I mean, certainly you and I have been doing this. We've been in writers' rooms on other things. Where that inciting incident happens, where a big character comes in, if you put that character in too late, the audience don't know they're important.
Yeah.
You and I had this on Paddington, where Hugh Grant arrived too late.
Yeah.
And the preview audiences were going, who's that guy? Is he just a cameo?
Yeah. And that's a really big booking for a cameo.
Yeah, as in, is he just going to be... And then people weren't following him. When he turned up again, people, has he come back? Moving him further and further into that important first act where people are saying, give me the data. Who's it? Whose story is this?
Yeah.
Rachel, I think, in this, arrives after the point I've stopped listening for who the hero is. So she's Gunter. She's another person in the cafe.
I've decided that my best man is my best friend, Gunther.
What's my last name?
Central Perk.
Which is an amazing way of saying, don't worry about where she was.
Yeah.
It's just about these people, and they are all equal. It's really clever.
I remember that, watching it, and feeling in the back of my mind, this is before I was, you know, a writer. I was at university when I first sort of got into it. I remember thinking that she was like a story of the week.
Yes.
So, Rachel, what are you up to tonight?
Well, I was kind of supposed to be headed for Aruba on my honeymoon, so nothing.
It feels like that.
Yeah.
Because she would arrive earlier if we were going to talk about the Jilted Bride. And also, she's got an important role in this, in that she is a slight outsider who has to get to know the people. So normally what you do at the beginning is you bring someone in and say, meet the guys.
Yeah.
But she comes in after that. You don't follow her, and she's not the audience's representative.
Yeah.
I never felt that. And that's not how you normally start a sitcom. And I think that we probably underappreciate what a sea change in the ensemble sitcom this is. Because even though they're just hanging out in New York, it's not Seinfeld.
Yeah.
It's not named after one of them. And when it came to negotiating their fees, they negotiated together.
Mm.
There's no star.
Yeah.
It's not how an American sitcom usually works. It's certainly not how they tell these stories normally.
No.
Maybe it's more revolutionary than we remember. Because after this, everyone makes lovely ensemble stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it might be a big change in how America looked at big ensemble sitcoms.
Yeah.
Because they are all equal in that first episode, and it stays the same way.
Do you all feel that way? Do you feel like the show really evolves around a single character, or it's more the interaction between all of you?
Yeah, it's absolutely. It's the entire cast together.
To us down here, it just seems like we're all just a sort of a theater group. You know?
It's weird as well when you look at it structurally, because it's sort of perfect, but what feels so alien when you rewatch the first episode, having then watched multiple series that followed, is you're so used to the relatively quick-paced cross-cutting between story threads involving the different friends. That first half, when they do dissolves and the little, you know, and then they come back to the same people on the same set, it feels so alien.
Where did Phoebe go?
Yeah, exactly.
She went, she came back, didn't she?
Had
her adventure and came back.
Yeah, exactly. That feels really, really unusual. But also, like you say, bringing in the fact that not only do they bring in Jennifer Aniston's character so late, but the fact that she's not brought in to set up a gag or set up a story. She's a punchline to a joke.
Yes.
I just want to be married again.
So she feels deliberately flippant when she comes in. She's a punchline to a joke, you know, in terms of the format.
Yeah, yeah.
That someone literally set it up, and in her appearance, the punchline. But also, she's dressed as a punchline to a joke. And so you feel like she can't have any weight to her. And it was really surprising when you watched the second episode. Oh, she's still there. I wonder how long she's sticking around for. And it's only about like 2-3 episodes in that you're like, I think she might be a regular.
Yes.
I mean, just going to settle down into this.
Look, Daddy, it's my life. Well, maybe I'll just stay here with Monica. Well, I guess we've established she's staying here with Monica.
So you're looking at characters like Rachel and going, is she one of the, is it six? Is it five and she's a floating character who comes in and out? Will she be in it for a few episodes and then disappear? That person who we're not seeing a lot of, Phoebe, is she just like a secondary friend? She doesn't live in the same building as the others. Is she a secondary character? And it takes you a while to go, it's all of them all the time, and they come in and out of each other's lives, houses, places of work.
Maybe that's why they don't intercut.
Yeah.
Because I remember thinking mechanically, as soon as you learn how Americans are trained to write sitcom, which is ABC plot.
Yeah.
Was the classic syndicated studio sitcom is an A and B and C plot. And the best way to do an A and B and C plot is to have two characters in each plot. That gives you six people. I mean, it's a mathematically formulated show to generate A, B and C plots. You can swap them over.
Yeah.
But the idea is they all go on an adventure separately in twos.
Yes.
You want them to pair off and go and have adventures. But if you did that in the first episode and you didn't like one of those plots, you'd go, the people who had that plot, they're not my favourites.
Yeah.
Even though it knows it can cut away to A, B and C plots, it doesn't do it for two episodes to say, no, look at all of them.
Yeah.
get to them all, and then when we start to separate them off, you'll know how Phoebe and Monica will react to each other. You know how Ross and Chandler will react to each other. They've got their stated A, B, and C's, and they start to split apart, but by then you know them all.
Yeah. Hey!
Welcome to the real world. It sucks. You're gonna love it.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, Rach, the big question is, does he like you? Right? Because if he doesn't like you, this is all a moot point.
Huh. A moot point?
Yeah. It's like a cow's opinion. It just doesn't matter. It's moo.
It was interesting as well, seeing that sort of process of refinement. And it happens a little bit across those first few episodes that you see actors finding their characters a little bit. But I think particularly across the first season and going into series two, when you think about Joey now, you go, he's a lovable idiot. But you go, when you first watch him, he's a vain Lothario.
Yeah.
That's his character type.
You're feeling a lot of pain right now. You're angry. You're hurting. Can I tell you what the answer is? Strip joints!
And then as he starts to become a little bit more of a lovable fool character, there's a period where there's a strange crossover with Phoebe and you start to go, where do those two characters sit differently? And she was, you know, ethereal and new agey.
We can burn the stuff they gave us.
Or
we can chant and dance around naked, you know, with sticks.
But the fact that she just thought differently as opposed to wasn't so smart, that suddenly that then found that, oh, that's what it is about her.
She gets a whimsical brain, but they work out after a while he's a dog.
Yeah.
Which weirdly, I think that's why you forgive the horniness, is you go, well, his behaviour is the same we expect from a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine you've borrowed that in Ghosts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no matter how much you try and avoid being formulaic, it's funny how quickly, if you're trying to write something where it's an ensemble and you need character types for there to be interesting dynamics and stories to work, that you end up with one who's a bit based, a bit foolish, a bit stupid.
Think about it, Robin. Man has always looked up at the moon and thought,
can you eat it?
No, can you walk on it?
You need someone who fulfills that role.
She spoke to me.
What? No, she did not.
Did, said,
I don't think that's a word, Robin.
No. Tis, I had a cousin, that's all he said.
What, or equally someone who's, just naive.
Yeah.
And those can be the same characters, those can be split. I suppose, the equivalent, Kitty might be the closest equivalent we have to a Phoebe in Ghosts, that you sort of have someone who's naive and open, but equally, there's a sort of side to her and you wouldn't cross.
Fine, but I'm not letting you go in my canoe.
Weirdly, you need something that sits in that role. I suppose Robin's a little bit, he's the most foolish character in Ghosts, but also there's an unexpected wisdom sometimes comes from him. And that's something that you get from Phoebe, because she's got street smarts as well. You know, she's I love her backstory.
I remember when I first came to this city, I was 14. My mom had just killed herself and my stepdad was back in prison. And I got here and I didn't know anybody. And I ended up living with this albino guy who was like cleaning windshields outside Port Authority. And then he killed himself.
Yeah, she's lived more than they have.
Yeah.
Because I like as their backstories start to reveal themselves, you realise they've all got depths beneath the initial characters. What you're setting up, hopefully, for anyone watching a sitcom, Ghosts or Friends, is to say, you know these people.
Yes.
I'm Chandler, I make jokes when I'm uncomfortable.
They remind you not only of people from other sitcoms, because that's a really good shorthand, it really does help. And that's just, God, that's clowning, that's fine.
Yeah.
There are set clown troops, this has been around since Commedia dell'arte.
Yeah.
How do you think Carry On works? There's a horny one and a vain one, and there's a fluttery one, they've all got different roles. But you also recognise them from your life, from your family, from your workplace. I love the fact that Blackadder works because it's just a workplace analogue.
Yeah.
He's got bosses and minions and he's in the middle. He's middle management.
Yeah.
It's just a workplace sitcom set in the past. They are somewhere else, but you recognise them from your ordinary life.
Mm.
And there's a thing in Friends where that's a family, that Monica is slightly mumsy. But occasionally they'll swap roles, again, like happens in Ghosts, that suddenly Phoebe will suddenly become incredibly maternal and an incredibly soft place to land.
Yeah.
They can switch between them, but they are always an analogue of something with which you're familiar. And you as an audience then go, well, I know what they'll do because that's what my dog does.
Yes. Yeah.
Hey, did you get the turkey bacon? Oh, my God! Who is that?
It's Joey. I can't. It's stuck.
Well, I don't care that turkey has to feed 20 people at my parents' house and they're not going to eat it off your head.
One of the interesting things with any ensemble set of characters is everyone immediately goes, that's my favourite. Did you ever think where you watched it and suddenly I was in a shared house and everyone chose their favourite immediately? You weren't allowed anyone else's favourite in my house. You had to choose one each.
Yeah, that's all. But I think you always sort of slightly fit. One, it's that weird thing about comedy where you want to be the person who gets the jokes the most, or you know, that you want part of it to be yours. And I suppose as soon as you're going, oh, I like that character that you really like, that sense of ownership is maybe slightly diluted. I mean, I was always, it's probably telling actually, now I'm thinking about it, and maybe that's why, partly why Robin ended up being the way he is, but I was always a huge fan of Joey.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, he's a simple soul.
Yeah,
but he's not a traditional idiot. Do you know what I mean? He's not the village idiot. In fact, he's sort of the most aspirational of all of them in that he literally wants fame and fortune.
Yes.
And if anyone needs help pretending to like it, I learned some things in acting class. Try rubbing your stomach or saying, and smiling.
Yeah, I'm not going to pay for those acting classes anymore.
And in some ways achieves the most in that despite all of the failings he's got as a character, he ends up being a regular character on a syndicated US
It's a show about people who are losers in love, and he is not a loser in love.
Please, could she be more out of my league? Ross, back me up here.
He can never get a woman like that in a million years.
Thank you, buddy.
If the aim is constantly to be dating, he's always dating.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gets those women. He weirdly always made me think they bunged a load of the characters from Cheers together in a blender. So he had Sam Malone plus Woody. So he's this incredible womanizing, charming sort of guy, but completely guileless and innocent as well. I mean, he got all the dumb jokes as well. It's a potent comic weapon, is Joey.
It tastes like feet.
I like it. Are you kidding? What's not to like? Custard? Good. Jam? Good. Meat? Good.
I think he's sort of like, he's like a really good pop song. And then you have Chandler like a deep cut album track. And you get the idea that love interests would come in. And they did this as something they did more than once. But love interests come in and immediately are drawn to Joey. And then it takes a little bit of time. And then you realise that actually Chandler's sort of more rounded and funnier and kinder. And,
I was trying to work out what Chandler's essence is straight away, because everyone said at the time he gets the best lines.
Yeah.
And it feels like he's the only thing they imported from Seinfeld. He's the one who's cynical and flip, and he's got that. I mean, even the could it be anymore? Dialogue, that's Seinfeld dialogue.
Well, maybe you're going about this the wrong way, you know? I mean, think about it. Single white male, divorced 3 times, 2 illegitimate children. The personal ad writes itself.
That's funny. Do you think you'll ever work again?
What are you doing? You know I can only dish it out.
Yeah. So he's got a stand-ups, an American stand-up in a sitcom's rhythm.
Yes.
He would be the lead in another show that had a lead. He'd be the cynical guy who's unlucky in love with his horny best mate and his daft friends.
Yeah.
Do you like some gum?
Oh, is it sugarless?
Sorry, it's not.
Oh, then no thanks. What the hell was that? Mental note, if Jill Goodacre offers you gum, you take it. If she offers you mangled animal carcass, you take it.
But this one, they've made them all leads. I was watching it again and going, oh my God, I hadn't realised how much he's got that. Very Gen X, very hip, laconic thing that probably we now go, oh, that's just the Friends tone.
Yeah.
But would have felt quite cool at the time.
Well, I think he's... Part of the character trait they've given him is he's sharp and funny, which means he's got carte blanche to do jokes.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the others are like, you know, he's doing that thing that I remember when I sort of started out in writing, that they told you to do the complete opposite of that. And they're like, you've just got to be true to the character and everything's got to come from character. Yeah. And there's always a bit of me that was like, but if you structure something like that and like that, it's a really funny gag.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was sort of frowned upon to put like gags into dialogue, because and particularly if in some ways you had to slightly, not crowbar, but delicately nudge a character to make the gag fit.
Yeah.
That all of the others, it feels like most of their comedy comes from their characters and the situation, whereas Chandler sort of is given the rights to go, I'm going to do a joke here.
All right, when was 1990? Okay, you have to stop the Q-tip when there's resistance.
He's the writer's room. He's the writer's room with that. So you need space for those gags. And I think what's lovely about this and any good ensemble comedy is that the idea is to have someone in each key that the joke can bounce off.
Yeah.
So if it needs to go in one direction, there's always... I compare it to a pinball table. Mm. You fire the pinball of a joke in and it should bounce off and score as many points off the mushrooms as possible. So you have to position them in places where the ball will definitely bounce off them. So you don't cluster them all in one place. So they're not all Chandler. They're not all witty. They're not all dumb. They're not all sexually underconfident or overconfident. So a joke that's sexually underconfident can bounce off Ross and an overconfident can bounce off Joey. Wherever that joke goes, the audience will know when it goes ping off that mushroom. They go, that's the right mushroom. 1,000 points. And you maximise your score for any joke. So very often you only need to fire one joke into Brooklyn Nine-Nine's squad room or the Friends coffee shop or Frasier's coffee shop or the bar in Cheers. It will bounce off everyone because they're perfectly positioned and they cover areas that no one else is covering. Like a netball team with those tabards on. They've got positions. And it's great that one of them has just gone, if there's a writer's room gag, we give it to the guy who represents that feeling the writers have, is it doesn't matter how funny I am, I'm just a schlub in the corner and no one's listening.
It makes him hard to pin down for that reason, because he's sort of like, it makes it, in terms of the comedy, he's sort of the most important, because he's got the banner out that's going, I'm the funny one in this comedy.
Yeah.
And yet he's sort of the hardest to pin down as a character type, where you go, okay, there's a nerdy one, there's a neurotic one, there's a stupid one, you know, and you go, what is Chandler? He's sort of the funniest, which makes it feel like he's going to be the lightest, but he's also in some ways the darkest and the slightly most troubled, and he's a bit underconfident and unsure of himself.
He's low status.
Slightly cynical,
he's very good. He's high status comedically as I'm the funniest guy here, but making up for the fact that he's low status in that he hates his job and no one takes him seriously, his romantic life's a disaster. He's a lovely blend of those things, so he's not a smart-assed bastard, so you still like him. And if you look at how they broke people down, that first series is a great masterclass in how they introduce people to give them their tags. You know Monica's neurotic. She's putting out coasters and things like that.
Yeah.
They take a while to push the contrast up on her as much as they do on the other characters. She's definitely carrying some vanilla flavouring to say, this is just someone you can understand. She's sympathetic, but she's a bit brittle.
Yeah.
Someone's left a glass on the coffee table. There's no coaster. It's a cold drink. It's a hot day. Little beads of condensation are inching their way closer and closer to the surface of the wood.
Stop it!
It was interesting, Courtney Cox fought for that part.
Right.
Because she was the most experienced sitcom person. And she said, I think she's the strongest and the most interesting person. So they wanted to cast her as Rachel because they thought she's quite sunny and upbeat. Right. And she went, no, I want to be that. And I think she's brilliant. She's taking a very unpromising part and she holds it for a long time in that first season. She's holding it together.
Hmm. I can't stop smiling. I can see that. You look like you slept with a hanger in your mouth.
I know. He's just so... You remember you and Tony DeMarco?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's like that, with feelings.
She's got a lot of the story weight on her and things. It takes her a while for her to get really funny stories about being anxious.
Yes.
Whereas you bring Rachel in and she sweeps in and she's spoilt.
Yeah.
She's a princess. And you go, 1,000 jokes.
Come on, you can't live off your parents your whole life.
I know that. That's why I was getting married.
Because you know who that is. And her relationship with Rachel having come from school and they can tease each other. I didn't realise they put the fat joke in straight away.
Yeah.
That Monica was fat at school.
Some girl ate Monica.
Shut up. The camera adds 10 pounds.
So how many cameras are actually on you?
Which everyone finds really problematic now.
Yeah.
But weirdly is a great note because we should talk about one of the big issues with Friends is they are all beautiful.
Yeah.
Even the Nevish, even Ross is an astonishingly, they are just beautiful people.
Yeah.
So you've got to give them loads of character to make the audience understand they're not absolutely alpha.
Yeah.
No one ever listens to me. When the package is this pretty, no one cares what's inside.
You have to really make sure you dial up their flaws.
Yeah. Because that's where the comedy's coming from.
Yeah, yeah.
Is Rachel here? I'm her sister.
Oh, my God. Well, this is Chandler.
Hi.
And you know Monica and Ross.
Hi,
and that's Phoebe. And that's Joey.
Hey, how you doing?
Don't.
You're not aware of it because that's the only version that exists. If there had been a British version of Friends and then you saw that, and when they've made everybody beautiful, there's the famous Red Dwarf pilot where, you know, they've made Lister into kind of this handsome jock and you go, no.
Can we pretend this is an alternate universe where this is the American version of Peep Show?
Yeah.
And it went really, really big. We barely remember the British version, but the American version was sexy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think my first reaction when I first watched it was to go, I really liked American comedy. I was a really big fan of Taxi, a really big fan of Cheers. I liked Seinfeld and things. And Friends came out, and I watched it and went, oh, my God, I won't watch this because these people are too pretty to be funny.
Yeah, where's Danny DeVito?
Yeah, where's where's Andy Kaufman and Christopher Lloyd?
Urge.
Yeah, it used to be there was one guy, there was one good-looking guy.
Yeah, exactly. You're all Sam Malone, what's going on?
The rule is one Fonz per show, and you're here to have six Fonzes, and some of them are girls.
Yeah.
It was like watching Days of Our Lives. It looked like an American soap.
Hmm.
And I was immediately British cynical of it. Until I realised how funny it was. And then watching it again now, I realise how much work they're doing. They are a massively attractive cast.
Yeah.
But they're doing a lot of work to say, no, we are playing characters.
Yeah, you've got to really, really be doing hard graft to go, don't worry, see through how beautiful we are to how damaged we are.
Yes, it's great. It's really clever. And I think that, my cynicism about it was say, this is a slick show.
Yeah.
Not realising it was a slick show, writing... Production,
no, but it looks
too slick.
It's very network.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely slick, and particularly, it's multi-camera and studio, and that carries with it certain expectations as well. It's bright and stark and everything that you expect from that, and part of that is the fact that this cast come in and they're all smiley and beautiful. And I think the first thing I thought when I saw it was I wasn't expecting it to be terribly well written.
Yeah.
Because it looks like there were plenty of those shows that were also rans, the things I don't really want to mention any by name, but the sort of things that would end up playing like late afternoon on Channel 4, and there were enough series of it for it to be syndicated, but it's broadly forgettable. And I suppose that's what I was expecting from it, from how it looked.
Yeah.
But the characters were better, more flawed, and it was funnier.
Maybe that's what it did. Is that it had the shell and the delivery system of an extremely slick syndicated studio product.
Hmm.
But its creators had come from HBO, where they would have been allowed to do Edge. I mean, that's the subscription thing. You don't have to have big audiences. They brought those values and that frankness about sex and a bit of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes in. There was an accusation leveled at it by Cameron Crowe. I don't know if you know this one, that Cameron Crowe said, that was my idea.
Right.
And he had been pursued by the studio to get the TV rights to his film Singles.
Right.
The Gen X grunge relationship thing, Bridget Fonda and Matt Dillon and people.
In the absence of sex, you go for companionship.
You want to get some dinner? Busy. How about some lunch? Have a lunch. Coffee? Water? How about some water?
Great film. Completely forgot. I remember really enjoying that film. And it was about dating. And he said they tried to develop it and it failed. And then a couple of years later, this thing comes out that is basically built on the chassis of Gen Xers hanging out post-grunge.
Yeah.
Soon you're just happy to have a friend.
You know, in a parallel universe, we're probably a scorching couple.
But in this one, neighbors.
But it's got those values of a Richard Linklater kind of grunge. Underneath all that slickness, what they're talking about, when Shonda delivers a very dark line or Phoebe talks about her mum's death or the undercurrents of this are grungy.
Yeah.
But it's got that feeling of, you know, when Sonic Youth objected to there being a grunge fashion show, you went, oh, actually, you're at some point, the corporate machine will go, it'd be great if they were really well showered and their hair was great. But it's kind of a Kevin Smith movie, but when everyone's had a bath.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not sure about the Sex Pistols. What about Blondie?
It's been cleaned up, but its values and its dialogue and being, I'm Gen X, you're Gen X, it was speaking to me. And the weird thing was to watch these very slick people talking in the dialogue that you'd expect from maybe a Jon Favreau movie from Swingers and things. It had those values of a little American indie movie in the jokes. And that felt really cool. You went, oh, actually, do I want to watch the kind of indie movie that would normally have a couple of kind of quirky looking people in it? But these people are beautiful. Do you know what? I'll happily watch that. Yeah. And do you know who else will happily watch that? I think just about everybody.
Yeah,
and it was reselling a sense of humour, I think, a slightly cynical sense of humour.
Yeah.
In a very slick package.
Yeah.
And once you got over going, they've wrapped it in really nice wrapping. It was bloody lovely, wasn't it?
Yeah. All my life, waiting for somebody. Come and take my hand. All my life, waiting for somebody. Your job's a joke to throw. Your love, that's the old way. It's like you're always stuck in second gear. When it hasn't been your day.
Let's take a break there. That's the end of part one. Part two along, well, pretty soon, as soon as I finished editing it, in which Larry will talk more about Friends, how that show works, and how his own show works, and the relationship between the two, and what it's like to be in a hit comedy with six mates. I think he should know. Anyway, look forward to that. Part two coming very soon. See you there. Comfort Blanket was presented and produced by Joel Morris for the Cheese and Pickle family of podcasts. Find us on social media, and don't forget to like and subscribe.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com